Okay, Isaiah chapter 16. Isaiah 16. We are in the middle of a prophecy that began in chapter 15. Start off with the burden of Moab, or the oracle, the prophecy about Moab. God was warning the Moabites. Judgment would be coming. First, there would be an invasion from the north. As the people would cry out to their Moabite god, Chemosh, nothing would happen. The Moabites would flee to the south, only to find that the south had been struck with a drought and that there was no food. And those people that weren't killed by the northern invaders would be attacked by lions. Things go from bad to worse. As the Moabites are fleeing, they would apparently go south all the way into the land of Edom. Oh, all right. Oh. Thanks, Rhody. Now, see, this map has got us pictured around the Dead Sea. Israel is on the left of the Dead Sea. And to the right of the Dead Sea, we've got, that's modern Jordan nowadays. And if you take the middle part of the Dead Sea, there's a river called the Arnon River. To the north of that is traditionally thought of as ancient Moab. To the south of that is ancient Edom, and even though some of it kind of mixes up and it's not all black and white. But that's generally what we look at, as Moab is to the north, Edom is to the south. And so the people have been fleeing. We read all about the different attacks that would be coming and all the different cities mentioned. And they're fleeing all the way down to the south. And we're going to pick it up in chapter 16, verse 1, where it's going to be talking about the city of Selah down in the south, which at one time was one of the capitals of ancient Edom. It is also known by another name, as the name of the city of Petra. You know it if you are an Indiana Jones fan. How many of you saw Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade? The Last Crusade. The Last Crusade. That's the point towards the end where they're riding through the narrow canyon, you know, and they come and it opens up and there's this big temple built into the rock. That's a real place. That wasn't even done with graphics. Now the inside part was done with the fake stuff. The inside wasn't anything like the real. But there, that's the rock city of Petra. It's an ancient Edomite city built into the rock. And so we pick it up in verse 1. See, the Moabites have fled south to Selah. Or Petra. Send ye the lamb to the ruler of the land from Selah to the wilderness unto the mount of the daughter of Zion. And it shall be that as a wandering bird cast out of the nest, so the daughters of Moab shall be at the fords of Arnon. Now, they don't go to the Chevys of Arnon or the Toyotas. They go to the fords. Oh, Arnon, how many of you are visitors for the first time? You're going to have to suffer through jokes like this the whole morning. Sorry. Now, what's happening is this. This send a lamb to the ruler of the land. It was a common thing in those days, these ancient times, where to keep the peace, you pay off the big bully of the block kind of a thing. And so if you were one of the weaker nations, well, you'd have to pay tribute. You'd have to, now that doesn't mean you just put on a big gala award show, you know, where I went right over your heads. Okay. But you would pay them, like, for example, with sheep or with lambs. The Moabites had paid tribute to the Israelites all the way back to the days of David, which is around 1000 B.C., Right now, Isaiah is writing around 700 or so B.C. At one point, the Moabites were paying tribute to the king of Israel, the wicked king Ahab, where they paid 100,000 lambs in 1 year and 100,000 rams in 1 year. That's 200,000 sheep in 1 year. That was their yearly tribute that they had to keep up with the Israelites. And so the idea, but see, they've stopped doing that. And so now, And so these people have fled to the south, and the encouragement comes to the Moabites. You need to send some tribute lambs to Jerusalem. Unto the mount of the daughter of Zion. you know, you need to look to Jerusalem for help. And it says, for it shall be that as the wandering bird casts out of the nest. It's like, you know, all the nests are out and all the birds are scattered and without a nest. They don't know where to go. And it says, so the daughters of Moab will be at the fords of the Arnon, where you would cross the Arnon River. They're crossing south. They're heading down to the Edomites. And then we pick it up in verse 3. Take counsel, execute judgment. Make thy shadow as the night in the midst of the noonday. Hide the outcasts. Bewray, or don't uncover, don't betray them, that him that wandereth. Let mine outcasts dwell with thee, Moab. Be thou a covering to them from the face of the spoiler. For the extortioner is at an end, the spoiler ceaseth, the oppressors are consumed out of the land, and in mercy shall the throne be established, and he shall sit upon it in truth in the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking judgment and hasting righteousness. Now let's just talk about verse 5 for a second. Who is the one who will sit on the throne of David and rule with mercy and righteousness and do everything right? Jesus. So here, just at now, I got to tell you, verses 3, 4, and 5, much controversy over verses 3, 4, and 5. It goes right back, to the way you translate verses 3 and 4. Nobody argues about verse 5. So let me just talk about verse 5 for a second. It's talking about Jesus sitting on his throne. This is when Jesus comes back to establish his kingdom. But wait a minute, I thought we were talking about a prophecy that was talking about warning of Moab, of the coming Assyrians and the Babylonians and stuff, and then Jesus didn't come back then. What's going on? Well, let's try to make some clarity out of this. The problem, there are two schools of thought, and it all goes back to the translation. If you've got one of the modern translations, NIV, New American Standard, or New Living Translation, how many of you have one of those translations? Okay, you are probably totally confused as I'm reading through this because it's like not tracking. It's like I'm reading about one thing and you're reading about another thing. You have to understand, it's not that people are making up their own Bible when you get differences in translations. We're talking about translating an ancient language into something in modern language. And sorry to say, sad to report, we don't have ancient Hebrew dictionaries telling us what each Hebrew word means. Some of this stuff, we get best ideas. Some of it is so vague that, I mean, you either add a few words to try to make it sound like what you think it ought to sound like, which is what some of the newer translations have done here, or else you just make it sound vague, which is what King James has done, and the New King James has done. For example, let me try to give you what each side is saying. The modern translation, let me just read to you NIV. It says this, verses 3 and 4. Give us counsel. And by the way, the NIV makes it sound as if the Moabites are speaking, the ones who've been fleeing. Okay? So the NIV makes it sound like the Moabites are continuing to speak. And they say, give us counsel, render a decision, make your shadow like night at high noon. Hide the fugitives, do not betray the refugees. Let the Moabite fugitives stay with you, be their shelter from the destroyer. The oppressor will come to an end and destruction will cease, the aggressor will vanish from the land. So, see, the way the modern translations will read, their idea is that the Moabites who are fleeing from this invasion are making a request to Jerusalem. Can we come stay with you? Okay? That's the way those are reading. Okay? That's what their intent is in translating it. The King James and the New King James, I have a feeling, are probably a little closer to the actual wording of the Hebrew. I'm not making that up. Just because I like King James or New King James. See, even in the New American Standard, you can tell where they've added words to help the translation. they're in italics. You take the italics words out and you come up with the King James version of it. And with the King James version, it's not the Moabites that are speaking, but the speaking is coming from Jerusalem or from God, saying to them, I've got some refugees here. You need to take care of them. Now, that doesn't fit with the flow of some of the passage. We've been talking about the Moabites fleeing, and now how come we come up with these Israeli refugees? What's happened here? Well, I'll explain that in a second. Well, no, I'll explain it right now. We've seen this several times in Scripture. In interpreting prophecy, we'll hit these places in prophecies where it's kind of like a hiccup in time. The technical word in biblical interpretation, we call it prophetic telescoping, where Scripture can leap 1,000 years in a single bound. And this isn't just to fit somebody's goofy scheme of prophecy. Jesus saw prophecy this way. In Luke chapter, I'm winging it because I didn't put this in my notes. In Luke, I think it's chapter 4 or 5 or 6, somewhere in there. When Jesus begins his ministry in Nazareth, he's handed the scroll and he begins to read from Isaiah, I think it's 61. You know, the passage, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me to heal the brokenhearted and all this kind of stuff, to bind up the wounded. Remember that thing? And Jesus read, and he said, this day, this scripture has been fulfilled. He rolled up the scroll, handed it back to the attendant, and sat down. You following me here? Unless you study the passage in Isaiah, you don't realize that Jesus didn't read the full passage. In fact, he didn't even finish the sentence. Because Isaiah's passage, right, in fact, in my Bible, it's a semicolon. That's where Jesus stopped reading, was at a semicolon. Because it's talking about the Spirit of the Lord being upon me, and to proclaim the day of vengeance of our God. Jesus didn't read that part. Why? Because the day of the vengeance of our God is future. That hasn't been fulfilled yet. That will be fulfilled at his second coming. And so, see, even Jesus, right, he takes a prophecy in Isaiah, and he chops it in half, and he says, there's a, you know, we skip 3,000 years. Right, from 2,000 years. From the one fulfillment to the next. I kind of think that's something that's going on here, my idea, in Isaiah 16. Other people look at it differently, that's okay. You can look at it differently, that's fine. But I get to be the preacher for the day, so you can't listen to me. See, up to this point, verses 1 and 2, we're talking about these Moabites fleeing the Babylonian invasion. And suddenly now, I think between 2 and 3, we have this little time travel. And the word goes out to the Moabites, who are living where? Okay, verse 1, where are they living? They're in Selah or Petra. Okay? They've fled to Selah or Petra. And word goes out to the Moabites saying, take counsel, execute judgment, make thy shadow as the night in the midst of the noonday. Hide the outcasts. Don't betray him that wandereth. In other words, you know, we got some people that are running for their lives. And you put a blanket of darkness over them. You cover them up. You hide them. Verse 4, God is saying, let mine outcasts dwell with thee, Moab. Be thou a covering to them from the face of the spoiler, for the extortioner is at an end. The spoiler ceaseth. The oppressors are consumed out of the land. I believe he's talking about the Antichrist and the persecution he will put upon the Jews at the middle point of the tribulation, where they'll be fleeing for their lives. He's the extortioner. He's the spoiler. But he will cease. The spoiler ceases. There will be an end. And because verse 5, in mercy shall the throne be established. See, Jesus is coming back. And so God exhorts these Moabites living in Petra. You take care of my outcasts. I mean, it's going to be for a little while, but this problem will be wiped, will be taken care of, because I'm coming back. Now, let me show you. There's a couple other scriptures that support this idea. Look at Revelation chapter 12. Revelation chapter 12. Now, I know I'm going to sound like some kooky prophecy guy who comes up with the goofiest scriptures. You're going to have to trust me on some of this stuff, or get the tapes when we went through Revelation. Chris has got them up on the internet, right, buddy? So you're going to have to trust me in Revelation 12, because it is chapter 12 is very symbolic. Not all of Revelation is as symbolic as people try to make it out to be, but chapter 12 was intended to be full of symbolism. He even is explaining the symbolism as it goes along. And it says in Revelation 12, verse 13, when the dragon saw that he was cast unto the earth, the dragon, we know right from Revelation itself, the dragon is Satan. We know that from Revelation chapter 11. Where is it? It's somewhere in there. I think it's in chapter 12. It mentions, there we go. So it's verse 9. It says who the dragon is. It's Satan. When Satan saw that he was cast unto the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. To the quick of it, the woman is Israel. She brought forth the man-child, the Messiah. We know that from the first part of the chapter. When Satan is cast out onto the earth, which will happen in the middle of the tribulation, he gets angry and he takes it out on the Jews. Verse 14, to the woman were given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place, where she is nourished for a time, times, and a half a time, from the face of the serpent. Time is one time. Times is two times. So one plus two is three. And a half a time is a half a time. So you have three and a half times. 3.5 years. Her place is where? In the wilderness. Now, maybe we're talking symbolically here, but to the Jews, typically the wilderness is a description of the southern area of Judah, the southern south of Jerusalem, that the desert area that crosses over into the land of Edom, that area south of the Dead Sea, that's called the wilderness. We're going to need the map in a second.
Yeah, sure. There we go. That's great. See this area down where Selah, Petra is. This is called the wilderness. It's the desert area, and so here it says that a woman, the two wings of a great eagle, somehow she'll be given help to fly into the wilderness, where her place is, where she'll be taken care of for 3.5 years. And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away of the flood. And the earth helped the woman. The earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth. Now, whether we're talking, again, symbols or not, the issue is this. The woman flees, finds a hiding place, and is protected there. Look at Isaiah chapter 63. One more scripture. Isaiah 63. Personally, I think some of us ought to consider investing in building condos at Petra. I'm kidding. Isaiah 63. Where's the book of Isaiah? Oh, gee, we're in it, aren't we? Isaiah 63. Now, you for homework, you might want to read the whole chapter. But Isaiah 63 parallels very closely something we read about in Revelation. Revelation 19, verses 13 through 16, which is Jesus coming back again on his white horse. And his robes, we're told, are dipped in blood. He's come back from treading the wine press, we're told. Isaiah 63, verse 1. Who is this that cometh from Edom with dyed garments from Basra? This that is glorious in his apparel, traveling in the greatness of his strength, I that speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Wherefore art thou red in thine apparel, and thy garments with like him that treadeth in the wine fat? I have trodden the winepress alone, and of the people there was none with me, for I tread them in mine anger, and trample them in my fury, and in their blood shall be sprinkled, and I will stain all my raiment. For the day of vengeance is in mine heart, and the year of my redeemed is come. Now, let me suggest to you. I know when we talk about Jesus coming back, we often look at the passage in Zechariah with the mountain splitting in half on Mount of Olives, and Acts chapter 1 where the angels talk about Jesus coming in the same manner to the, you know, where we see him lift up and all this kind of stuff. And so we usually have in our mind that when Jesus comes back, he's going to come back first onto the Mount of Olives. Let me suggest to you, I wonder if that's later. That's where he comes first when he hits Jerusalem. But I wonder if it is possible, if maybe, theoretically, when Jesus comes back, he first comes back to these people in Edom. In Isaiah 63, it says Basra. Basra, I printed my map before I was done. I shouldn't have printed it. There's a little blue plus down. You see where Selah is at the bottom? That's Basra. It's only 2 miles away. They're like neighbors. Okay? And I wonder if when Jesus comes back, it says there was none to help me. In other words, nobody would take care of the Jews. Nobody would protect them. Nobody would take up their cause. And when Jesus comes back, he'll take care of them. He'll come and he'll rescue them. And then probably, it says who's coming from Edom. That's when he's headed probably towards Jerusalem. Just a theory. Just an idea. I think that fits Isaiah 16. Let mine outcast dwell with thee, Moab. Be a covering for them from the face of the spoiler. Because this day is going to come to an end. Let's move on. Chapter Isaiah 16, verse 6. We have heard of the pride of Moab. He is very proud, even of his haughtiness and his pride and his wrath. But his lies shall not be so. Now, I think as we're looking at this whole section as a whole, chapters 15 and 16, we're looking at God's judgment, God's chastisement, God's getting their attention. Well, here we've got the root cause, the problem with Moab. Their problem was their pride. Their problem was their pride. They were world famous for their pride. We see this again in Jeremiah chapter 48. This is one of the trademarks of Moab. That's how you could tell a Moabite. They were proud people. But if you look at verse 6, I thought it was interesting. A couple words I'd circle. One is the word pride. The next word is wrath. And the next word is lies. Pride, wrath, and lies. Do you realize how often those things go together? Our pride, which makes us angry, which makes us... It's pride that makes you think that you're the best. A young woman went to her pastor and said, Pastor, I have a besetting sin and I want your help. I come to church on Sunday and I can't help thinking I'm the prettiest girl in the congregation. I know I ought not think that, but I can't help it. I want you to help me with it. The pastor replied, Mary, don't worry about it. In your case, it's not a sin. It's just a terrible mistake. It is pride that makes you think that you don't need to ask for help and that you shouldn't help others. That's what is happening with the Moabites. God's saying, look, ask for help. Send a tribute lamb.
Oh, no, I can handle it. You know, a bunch of guys. You know, never ask for directions, you know. That's why at 1492, Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue. He's heading for India. But did he ask for directions? No. And us men have been having problems ever since.
It's pride that makes you think you don't need to ask for help, but precious ones, we all need help. We all need help. It's not a sign of weakness that asks for help. It's a sign of smarts. We all need help. It is pride that fuels your anger at people when they don't do things the way you think they ought to be done. Executive consultant Richard Hegberg told this story. The head of one large company recently told me about an incident that occurred as he and his wife waited in line to get his driver's license renewed. He was frustrated at how long it was taking and grumbled to his wife, "Don't they know who I am?" She replied, and wives are good at this. She replied, "Yeah, you're a plumber's son who got lucky." Yeah. God bless our wives. We need them. Stupid, proudful men. It is pride that makes you lie to others to keep up the crumbling front that says you're the best. It's pride that fuels the lies. Look, you're no better than anyone else. And you know what? We all know it. So why lie? A mayor was very proud of his city and was asked how the recession had affected it. He answered, "We don't have a recession here, but I will admit we are having the worst boom in many years." We like to repackage stuff, don't we? Could it be that your anger would go away if you would humble yourself? If we'd humble ourselves, maybe it'd be a little easier to tell the truth. Maybe a little easier to ask for help. Verse 7. "Therefore Moab shall howl for Moab. Everyone shall howl." We flip back in time to this original judgment on Moab. "Therefore shall Moab howl for Moab. Everyone shall howl for the foundations of Kir Hareseth." That's one of the big cities. "Shall ye mourn? Surely they are stricken. For the fields of Heshbon languish." This was again another major city in Moab. "The fields of Heshbon languish, and the vine of Sibmah. The lords of the heathen have broken down the principal plants thereof." This is probably describing the attack of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, upon Moab. "They are come even unto Jazer." That was the city in the far north. "They wandered through the wilderness. Her branches are stretched out, and they are gone over the sea." In other words, some people have crossed the Dead Sea to the other side to get away. Verse 9, "Therefore I will bewail with the weeping of Jazer, the vine of Sibmah. I will water thee with my tears, O Heshbon and Elealeh. For the shouting for thy summer fruits and for thy harvest is fallen. And gladness is taken away, and joy out of the plentiful field and in the vineyards. There shall be no singing, neither shall there be shouting. The treaders shall tread out no wine in their presses. I have made their vintage shouting to cease." Now, you almost get the impression, there's a lot of stuff about grapes and vineyards and stuff like that through here, and you almost get the impression that the Moabites are most concerned that of everything, that their vineyards are getting wiped out. Their wine supply is getting wiped out. The Moabites were famous for being drunkards. That's how they got started. Lot, Abraham's nephew, remember they ran out of, went away from Sodom, and the daughters got Papa drunk. The Moabites were famous from that point on for being drunkards. Verse 11. "Wherefore my bowels shall sound like a harp for Moab, and mine inward parts for Kir Haresh," or Kir Hareseth. This is the prophet speaking. This is Isaiah the prophet speaking. "Wherefore my bowels shall sound like a harp for Moab." The ancient peoples looked at emotions differently than we do. For the ancient peoples, emotions come from your guts. We talk about it, "Oh, my heart is moved for you." Well, with them, they would say, "Oh, my guts are churning for you," kind of a thing. It doesn't sound real romantic, I know, but And no, don't try that with your sweetheart. My bowels shall...
He mentioned something about this back in Isaiah 15:5. Same people, same prophecy. He's saying, look, I'm all torn up inside about all this. I'm all torn up inside about all this. You know, prophecy is a strange thing. It comes in different ways, different manners. And sometimes it comes with impressions. Sometimes it... I've heard of people who just have the words flowing. They don't see any pictures. It's not thoughts or things. They just get actual words, you know. Some people, it's more the idea of a vision. And maybe that's what's happening here. Maybe he's actually seeing the pictures in his mind, CNN live, you know, as the Moabites are being wiped out by the Babylonians. And he says, man, I'm just all torn up inside over this. To have compassion for those who are in trouble. Even if you think they deserve it. To have compassion for those in trouble. Because, you know, I don't know about you, but there are some people that do deserve it. You know, we think about it. You look at somebody and go, well, look at all the trouble they're having. Boy, go get them, God. You know, and I think we need to have Isaiah's heart. To be torn up inside. As I mentioned last week, it's not that we don't talk about judgment. Just you don't have to enjoy it. It's important that we warn people about the truth that there is judgment ahead. God says, I take no pleasure in the death of the wicked. God's heart is that the wicked would turn around and find life in Him. You know the story in Luke chapter 10 where Jesus tells the story of a man who was on his way from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among thieves who beat him up and left him for dead. And that afternoon a priest walked by and saw the man lying there in his blood and his wounds and didn't want to get dirty, and he walked around him and off on his way. And then a Levite, one of the helpers in the temple, walked by and did the same thing, kind of avoided the man. But then one of those yucky, wicked, heathen, pagan Samaritans walked by and had compassion for the man. And he picked the man up. He washed his wounds. He cleansed them. Put the man on his donkey and took him to a place and put him up for the night. Paid his bill. And Jesus said, who was the man's neighbor? Well, the one who showed mercy. God's desire is that we have compassion for those in trouble, and that our compassion doesn't mean that we walk around them in the road. We learn to pick people up. The story comes from Howard Hendricks. He says, years ago in a church in Dallas, we were having trouble finding a teacher for a junior high boys class. We don't have that problem. The list of the prospects had only one name. And when they told me who it was, I said, you've got to be kidding. But I couldn't have been more wrong about that young man. He took the class, revolutionized it. I was so impressed, I invited him to my home for lunch and asked him the secret of his success. He pulled out a little black book. On each page, he had a small picture of one of the boys, and under the boy's name were comments like, having trouble in arithmetic, or comes to church against parents' wishes, or would like to be a missionary someday but doesn't think he has what it takes. I pray over those pages every day, he said, and I can hardly wait to come to church each Sunday to see what God has been doing in their lives. Sometimes it's kind of hard to work up compassion for people. You don't stick an air hose in and pump yourself up, Now I'm just bursting with compassion. I think one of the ways it comes, dear ones, is learning to really, sincerely,
pray for them. I don't mean pray for them like, God, take care of this mess. I don't want to have anything to do with it. Amen.
There, put them in God's hands.
No, but learn to weep for them. Have our hearts broken for them. Is there a person at work that you're having a little hard time being nice to, being compassionate to? Have you prayed for them? Praying that God would touch their hearts, God would soften them, God would show them how much they need Him. Maybe it's a neighbor, maybe it's somebody at your house. Oh God, give us compassion for those in need, like the prophet. And we have compassion for them. Let's move back to Isaiah. Verse 12, I think. And it shall come to pass when it is seen that Moab is weary on the high place, that he shall come to his sanctuary to pray, but he shall not prevail. Now, as we've mentioned before, the Moabites don't worship Yahweh. The Moabites worship a lot of gods, their main god being Chemosh, or which was a form of, I'm losing it here, Al. Molech, there we go. It was known by the Canaanites worshipped Molech, the god they would put the little babies in their arms and burn them to death. Oh, lovely stuff, huh? And the idea is that Moabites are having a hard time, so they, it's time to get religious! Man, my life's falling apart. I got to do the religion thing. So they go up to the high places because that's where the 7-Eleven of the religious stuff was located, up on all the little high places. You're closer to God, so you know things will get through somehow. You know, but the high places weren't working. So they go to their temple. We mentioned last week it was in the city of Nebo, at the foot of Mount Nebo, where they worship Chemosh. They go to their temple. Oh, Chemosh, oh, help us! Line is dead. Well, that's because there was never a dial tone in the first place. Chemosh ain't home. Can't answer your phone. All roads don't lead to God. Perhaps you're going through difficult times right now. And in desperation, you're giving the religion thing a try. Maybe you've come under coercion by a friend to come here. You'd really rather do it somewhere else. I got news for you. This may be my only shot. All roads do not lead to God. God has already told us how to reach Him. He's left His address. He's left His phone number. If you want to reach the real thing, you've got to call His number. I mean, let's say you heard that a cousin moved in from out of state, moved in across town, and shoot out, I'm going to go visit Cousin Elmer. I sure am. And so I get in my car, and I'm just going to head out to find Cousin Elmer. And I get on the 91 freeway, and off I go into the sunset to find me, my Cousin Elmer, because all roads lead to Cousin Elmer. Well, what a stupid thing. No, I'm going to end up in Long Beach or something, you know? No, you've got to find out where Elmer lives, and you've got to go to Elmer. If you're looking for God, you better start where He says you will find Him. And that's in His Son, Jesus. When Jesus said in John 14, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by Me. Some people look at that and they say, well, it's pretty narrow-minded. Actually, I kind of prefer to think that God's making a whole lot easier for us. There's one way. And you know what? It really isn't even a matter of being narrow-minded or not. It's a matter of taking God seriously when He's told you about Himself. It's not what I think. It's not what your friend thinks. It's what God thinks that counts. And God says you need to go to Jesus. It's not which church you go to per se. There are some churches I would avoid. But as we're going to find out Thursday night, there's a whole bunch of churches in Fullerton that are awesome, wonderful churches. We all worship the same God. It's not about which church. It's about coming to Jesus. The Moabites went to their God. Line was dead. You go to Jesus. He's always there for you. Verse 13, this is the word that the Lord hath spoken concerning Moab since that time. One translation says, this is the word that the Lord had already spoken. He's already spoken his part up to Moab, but now we're going to go for upgrade, Moab 1.1. We have an upgrade to the prophecy here, verse 14. But now the Lord hath spoken, saying, within 3 years, as the years of a hireling, and the glory of Moab shall be contemned or dishonored, despised. The bestest things about Moab will be yucky. With all that great multitude, and the remnant shall be very small and feeble. Now it says, within 3 years as the years of a hireling. A hireling, a guy that becomes your slave for a period of time. And he doesn't want to work for you longer than he has to. And so when a hireling works for you for 3 years, you know that when 3 years is up, he'll let you know because he wants out. He wants to get away. You know, and so the idea is that this isn't going to go 3.5 years. This isn't going to go 3.75 years. Man, we'll be lucky if we make it to 3 years. And this will happen. And the prophecy is this. You may have a lot of big stuff going for you, Moab, but judgment is coming and you're going to get shrunk down to a small remnant. Now, that's what would happen to Moab. They'd get shrunk down to small remnant in Isaiah's day. But they would come back. They'd multiply. They'd come back to being big old Moab again. Until in Jeremiah's day, the big judgment would come. So there are times when we're not doing what God wants us to do. We know it. God warns us. God says, look, I'd really like you to turn around. It's not really the best thing for you to be playing jacks on the freeway. I've got much better things for you. And we don't listen. God warns us again. He sends somebody who cares about you. You know, they just love on you. They tell you, you shouldn't be messing with this lady. It's not your wife. You need to get out of this relationship. That's okay. I can do all things. I'm not legalistic, And have my excuses. Have my things. And God warns. God lovingly warns. But there comes a day when sometimes, because it's the only thing to get your attention, boom, slap upside the head. Something to shake you up. And your life starts falling apart. And you know what? He gets your attention. And you go, oh, okay, God, I'm so sorry. I'll never do this anymore. I will never, ever do this. How could I have done this? Oh, God. And you start turning around. You start doing what you're supposed to do. You start being nice to your sweetie pie. You start taking care of what you're supposed to take care of. You get away from the people that are bad for you. And you start doing what's right. And you know what? Life gets easier. Moab got shrunk down to the remnant. Then things got better. Life was okay again. And they went back to their old ways. God's desire is that when we learn our lessons, you only have to learn them once. No need for repeats over and over and over. It gets better, and so I don't have to be nice to her anymore. Because we're okay. The marriage is saved. Wait a second. Since when do you stop being nice to your wife? No, let the turnaround be permanent. Some of us have made some turnarounds. Some of us, we've been rescued. Do you know what? I would encourage you to make it your pledge this morning to God. And every week, God, I don't want to go back. I want to stay in the place of safety. I want to stay in that place where I'm healthy.